the de facto monopoly. The tradition of theorizing about the state we discussed briefly in Chapter 2 has a state claiming a monopoly on the use of force. Has any monopoly element yet entered our account of the dominant protective agency? Everyone may defend himself against unknown or unreliable procedures, and may punish those who use or attempt to use such procedures against him. As its client's agent, the Protective Association has the right to do this for its clients. It grants that every individual, including those not affiliated with the association, has this right. So far, no monopoly is claimed. To be sure, there is a universal element in the content of the claim, the right to pass on anyone's procedure. But it does not claim to be the sole possessor of this right. Everyone has it. Since no claim is made that there is some right which it and only it has, no monopoly is claimed. With regard to its own clients, however, it applies and enforces these rights, which it grants that everyone has. It deems its own procedures reliable and fair. There will be a strong tendency for it to deem all other procedures, or even the same procedures run by others, either unreliable or unfair. But we need not suppose it excludes every other procedure. Everyone has the right to defend against procedures that are in fact not, or not known to be, both reliable and fair. Since the dominant protective association judges its own procedures to be both reliable and fair, and believes this to be generally known, it will not allow anyone to defend against them. That is, it will punish anyone who does so. The dominant protective association will act freely on its own understanding of the situation, whereas no one else will be able to do so with impunity. Although no monopoly is claimed, the dominant agency does occupy a unique position by virtue of its power. It, and it alone, enforces prohibitions on others' procedures of justice as it sees fit. It does not claim the right to prohibit others arbitrarily. It claims only the right to prohibit anyone's using actually defective procedures on its clients. But when it sees itself as acting against actually defective procedures, others may see it as acting against what it thinks are defective procedures. It alone will act freely against what it thinks are defective procedures, whatever anyone else thinks. As the most powerful applier of principles which it grants everyone the right to apply correctly, it enforces its will, which, from the inside, it thinks is correct. From its strength stems its actual position as the ultimate enforcer and the ultimate judge with regard to its own clients. Claiming only the universal right to act correctly, it acts correctly by its own lights. It alone is in a position to act solely by its own lights. Does this unique position constitute a monopoly? There is no right the dominant protective association claims uniquely to possess, but its strength leads it to be the unique agent acting across the board to enforce a particular right. It is not merely that it happens to be the only exerciser of a right it grants that all possess. The nature of the right is such that once a dominant power emerges, it alone will actually exercise that right. For the right includes the right to stop others from wrongfully exercising the right, and only the dominant power will be able to exercise this right against all others. Here, if anywhere, is the place for applying some notion of a de facto monopoly, a monopoly that is not de jure because it is not the result of some unique grant of exclusive right while others are excluded from exercising a similar privilege. Other protective agencies, to be sure, can enter the market and attempt to wean customers away from the dominant protective agency. They can attempt to replace it as the dominant one. But being the already dominant protective agency gives an agency a significant market advantage in the competition for clients. The dominant agency can offer its customers a guarantee that no other agencies can match. Only those procedures we deem appropriate will be used on our customers. The dominant protective agency's domain does not extend to quarrels of non-clients among themselves. If one independent is about to use his procedure of justice upon another independent, then presumably the protective association would have no right to intervene. It would have the right we all do to intervene to aid an unwilling victim whose rights are threatened. But since it may not intervene on paternalistic grounds, the protective association would have no proper business interfering if both independents were satisfied with their procedure of justice. This does not show that the dominant protective association is not a state. A state, too, could abstain from disputes where all concerned parties chose to opt out of the state's apparatus. Though it is more difficult for people to opt out of the state in a limited way by choosing some other procedure for settling a particular quarrel of theirs. For that procedure's settlement and their reactions to it might involve areas that not all parties concerned have removed voluntarily from the state's concern. And shouldn't, and mustn't, each state allow that option to its citizens? Protecting others. If the protective agency deems the independents' procedures for enforcing their own rights insufficiently reliable or fair when applied to its clients, it will prohibit the independents from such self-help enforcement. The grounds for this prohibition are that the self-help enforcement imposes risks of danger on its clients. Since the prohibition makes it impossible for the independents credibly to threaten to punish clients who violate their rights, it makes them unable to protect themselves from harm and seriously disadvantages the independents in their daily activities and life. Yet it is perfectly possible that the independents' activities, including self-help enforcement, could proceed without anyone's rights being violated, leaving aside the question of procedural rights. According to our principle of compensation given in Chapter 4, in these circumstances, those persons promulgating and benefiting from the prohibition must compensate those disadvantaged by it. The clients of the protective agency, then, must compensate the independents for the disadvantages imposed upon them by being prohibited self-help enforcement of their own rights against the agency's clients. Undoubtedly, the least expensive way to compensate the independents would be to supply them with protective services to cover those situations of conflict with the paying customers of the protective agency. This will be less expensive than leaving them unprotected against violations of their rights by not punishing any client who does so, and then attempting to pay them afterwards to cover their losses through having and being in a position in which they were exposed to having their rights violated. If it were not less expensive, then instead of buying protective services, people would save their money and use it to cover their losses, perhaps by jointly pooling their money in an insurance scheme. Must the members of the protective agency pay for protective services, vis-a-vis its clients, for the independents? Can they insist that the independents purchase the services themselves? After all, using self-help procedures would not have been without costs for the independent. The principle of compensation does not require those who prohibit an epileptic from driving to pay his full cost of taxis, chauffeurs, and so on. If the epileptic were allowed to run his own automobile, this too would have its costs: money for the car, insurance, gasoline, repair bills, and aggravation. In compensating for disadvantages imposed, the prohibitors need pay only an amount sufficient to compensate for the disadvantages of the prohibition, minus an amount representing the costs the prohibited party would have borne were it not for the prohibition. The prohibitors needn't pay the complete costs of taxis. They must pay only the amount which, when combined with the costs to the prohibited party of running his own private automobile, is sufficient for taxis. They may find it less expensive to compensate in kind for the disadvantages they impose than to supply monetary compensation. They may engage in some activity that removes or partially lessens the disadvantages, compensating in money only for the net disadvantages remaining. If the prohibitor pays to the person prohibited monetary compensation equal to an amount that covers the disadvantages imposed, minus the costs of the activity where it permitted, this amount may be insufficient to enable the prohibited party to overcome the disadvantages. If his costs in performing the prohibited action would have been monetary, he can combine the compensation payment with this money unspent and purchase the equivalent service. But if his costs would not have been directly monetary but involve energy, time, and the like, as in the case of the independent self-help enforcement of rights, then this monetary payment of the difference will not by itself enable the prohibited party to overcome the disadvantage by purchasing the equivalent of what he is prohibited. If the independent has other financial resources he can use without disadvantaging himself, then this payment of the difference will suffice to leave the prohibited party undisadvantaged. But if the independent has no such other financial resources, a protective agency may not pay him an amount less than the cost of its least expensive protective policy, and so leave him only the alternatives of being defenseless against the wrongs of its clients, or having to work in the cash market to earn sufficient funds to total the premium on a policy. For this financially pressed, prohibited individual, the agency must make up the difference between the monetary cost to him of the unprohibited activity and the amount necessary to purchase an overcoming or counterbalancing of the disadvantage imposed. The prohibitor must completely supply enough, in money or in kind, to overcome the disadvantages. No compensation need be provided to someone who would not be disadvantaged by buying protection for himself. For those of scanter resources, to whom the unprohibited activity had no monetary costs, the agency must provide the difference between the resources they can spare without disadvantage and the cost of protection. For someone for whom it had some monetary costs, the prohibitor must supply the additional monetary amount, over and above what they can spare without disadvantage, necessary to overcome the disadvantages. If the prohibitors compensate in kind, they may charge the financially pressed prohibited party for this, up to the monetary costs to him of his unprohibited activity, provided this amount is not greater than the price of the good. As the only effective supplier, the dominant protective agency must offer in compensation the difference between its own fee and monetary costs to this prohibited party of self-help enforcement. It almost always will receive this amount back in partial payment for the purchase of a protection policy. It goes without saying that these dealings and prohibitions apply only to those using unreliable or unfair enforcement procedures. Thus, the dominant protective agency must supply the independents, that is, everyone it prohibits from self-help enforcement against its clients on the ground that their procedures of enforcement are unreliable or unfair, with protective services against its clients. It may have to provide some person's services for a fee that is less than the price of these services. These persons may, of course, choose to refuse to pay the fee and do so without these compensatory services. If the dominant protective agency provides protective services in this way for independents, won't this lead people to leave the agency in order to receive its services without paying? Not to any great extent, since compensation is paid only to those who would be disadvantaged by purchasing protection for themselves, and only in the amount that will equal the cost of an unfancy policy when added to the sum of the monetary costs of self-help protection, plus whatever amount the person comfortably could pay. Furthermore, the agency protects these independents it compensates only against its own paying clients on whom the independents are forbidden to use self-help enforcement. The more free riders there are, the more desirable it is to be a client always protected by the agency. This factor, along with others, acts to reduce the number of free riders and to move the equilibrium toward almost universal participation. The State. We set ourselves the task in Chapter 3 of showing that the dominant protective association within a territory satisfied two crucial necessary conditions for being a state: that it had the requisite sort of monopoly over the use of force in the territory, and that it protected the rights of everyone in the territory, even if this universal protection could be provided only in a redistributive fashion. These very crucial facets of the state constituted the subject of the individualist anarchist's condemnation of the state as immoral. We also set ourselves the task of showing that these monopoly and redistributive elements were themselves morally legitimate, of showing that the transition from a state of nature to an ultra-minimal state, the monopoly element, was morally legitimate and violated no one's rights, and that the transition from an ultra-minimal to a minimal state, the redistributive element, was also morally legitimate and violated no one's rights. A protective agency dominant in a territory does satisfy the two crucial necessary conditions for being a state. It is the only generally effective enforcer of a prohibition on others using unreliable enforcement procedures, calling them as it sees them, and it oversees these procedures. And the agency protects those non-clients in its territory whom it prohibits from using self-help enforcement procedures on its clients, in their dealings with its clients, even if such protection must be financed, in apparent redistributive fashion, by its clients. It is morally required to do this by the principle of compensation, which requires those who act in self-protection in order to increase their own security to compensate those they prohibit from doing risky acts, which might actually have turned out to be harmless, for the disadvantages imposed upon them. We noted in beginning Chapter 3 that whether the provision of protective services for some by others was redistributed would depend upon the reasons for it. We now see that such provision need not be redistributive, since it can be justified on other than redistributive grounds, namely those provided in the principle of compensation. Recall that redistributive applies to reasons for a practice or institution, and only elliptically and derivatively to the institution itself. To sharpen this point, we can imagine that protective agencies offer two types of protection policies: those protecting clients against risky private enforcement of justice, and those not doing so but protecting only against theft, assault, and so forth, provided these are not done in the course of private enforcement of justice. Since it is only with regard to those with the first type of policy that others are prohibited from privately enforcing justice, only they will be required to compensate the persons prohibited private enforcement for the disadvantages imposed upon them. The holders of only the second type of policy will not have to pay for the protection of others, there being nothing they have to compensate these others for. Since the reasons for wanting to be protected against private enforcement of justice are compelling, almost all who purchase protection will purchase this second type of protection, despite its extra costs, and therefore will be involved in providing protection for the independents. We have discharged our task of explaining how a state would arise from a state of nature without anyone's rights being violated. The moral objections of the individualist anarchist to the minimal state are overcome. It is not an unjust imposition of a monopoly. The de facto monopoly grows by an invisible hand process and by morally permissible means, without anyone's rights being violated, and without any claims being made to a special right that others do not possess. And requiring the clients of the de facto monopoly to pay for the protection of those they prohibit from self-help enforcement against them, far from being immoral, is morally required by the principle of compensation, adumbrated in Chapter 4. We canvassed in Chapter 4 the possibility of forbidding people to perform acts if they lack the means to compensate others for possible harmful consequence of these acts, or if they lack liability insurance to cover these consequences. Were such prohibition legitimate, according to the principle of compensation, the persons prohibited would have to be compensated for the disadvantages imposed upon them, and they could use the compensatory payments to purchase the liability insurance. Only those disadvantaged by the prohibition would be compensated, namely those who lack other resources they can shift, without disadvantaging sacrifice, to purchase the liability insurance. When these people spend their compensatory payments for liability insurance, we have what amounts to public provision of special liability insurance. It is provided to those unable to afford it, and covers only those risky actions which fall under the principle of compensation, those actions which are legitimately prohibited when uncovered, provided disadvantages are compensated for, actions whose prohibition would seriously disadvantage persons. Providing such insurance almost certainly would be the least expensive way to compensate people who present only normal danger to others for the disadvantages of the prohibition, since they then would be insured against the eventuation of certain of their risks to others. These actions then would not be prohibited to them. Thus, we see how, if it were legitimate to prohibit some actions to those uncovered by liability insurance, and this were done, another apparent redistributive aspect of the state would enter by solid libertarian moral principles. Does the dominant protective agency in a given geographical territory constitute the state of that territory? We have seen in Chapter 2 how the notion of a monopoly on the use of force is difficult to state precisely so that it does not fall before obvious counterexamples. This notion, as usually explained, cannot be used with any confidence to answer our question. We should accept a decision yielded by the precise wording of a definition in some texts only if that definition had been devised for application to cases as complicated as ours and had stood up to tests against a range of such cases. No classification in passing by accident can answer our question in any useful manner. Consider the following discursive description by an anthropologist. The concentration of all physical force in the hands of the central authority is the primary function of the state and is its decisive characteristic. In order to make this clear, consider what may not be done under the state form of rule. No one in the society governed by the state may take another's life, do him physical harm, touch his property, or damage his reputation, save by permission of the state. The officers of the state have powers to take life, inflict corporal punishment, seize property as fine or by expropriation, and affect the standing and reputation of a member of the society. This is not to say that in societies without the state one may take life with impunity, but in such societies, for example among Bushmen, Eskimo, and the tribes of Central Australia, the central authority that protects the household against wrongdoers is non-existent, weak, or sporadic, and it was applied among the Crow and other Indians of the Western Plains only as situations arose. The household or the individual is protected in societies without the state by non-explicit means, by total group participation in suppression of the wrongdoer, by temporarily or sporadically applied force that is no longer needed and so no longer used when the cause for its application is past. The state has means for the suppression of what the society considers to be wrongs or crimes: police, courts of law, prisons, institutions which explicitly and specifically function in this area of activity. Moreover, these institutions are stable within the frame of reference of the society and permanent. When the state was formed in ancient Russia, the ruling prince asserted the power to impose fines and to wreak physical pain and death, but allowed no one else to act thus. He asserted once again the monopolistic nature of the state power by withholding its power from any other person or body. If harm was done by one subject to another without the prince's express permission, this was a wrong, and the wrongdoer was punished. Moreover, the prince's power could only be explicitly delegated. The class of subject thus protected was thereby carefully defined, of course. By no means were all those within his realm so protected. No one person or group can stand in place of the state. The state's acts can only be performed directly or by express delegation. The state, in delegating its power, makes its delegate an agent, organ of the state. Policemen, judges, jail guards derive their power to coerce according to the rules of the society directly from the central authority. So do the tax collectors, the military, frontier guards, and the like. The authoritative function of the state rests on its command of these forces as its agents. The author does not claim that the features he lists are all necessary features of the state. Divergence in one feature would not serve to show that the dominant protective agency of a territory was not a state. Clearly, the dominant agency has almost all of the features specified, and its enduring administrative structures, with full-time specialized personnel, make it diverge greatly in the direction of a state from what anthropologists call a stateless society. On the basis of the many writings like that quoted, one would call it a state. It is plausible to conclude that the dominant protective association in a territory is its state, only for a territory of some size containing more than a few people. We do not claim that each person who, under anarchy, retains a monopoly on the use of force on his quarter acre of property is its state, nor are the only three inhabitants of an island one square block in size. It would be futile and would serve no useful purpose to attempt to specify conditions on the size of a population and territory necessary for a state to exist. Also, we speak of cases where almost all of the people in the territory are clients of the dominant agency, and where independents are in a subordinate power position in conflicts with the agency and its clients. We have argued that this will occur. Precisely what percentage must be clients and how subordinate the power position of the independents must be are more interesting questions, but concerning these I have nothing especially interesting to say. One additional necessary condition for a state was extracted from the Weberian tradition by our discussion in Chapter 2, namely that it claimed to be the sole authorizer of violence. The dominant protective association makes no such claim. Having described the position of the dominant protective association, and having seen how closely it fits anthropologists' notions, should we weaken the Weberian necessary condition so that it includes a de facto monopoly which is the territory's sole effective judge over the permissibility of violence, having a right, to be sure, one had by all, to make judgments on the matter and to act on correct ones? The case is very strong for doing so, and it is wholly desirable and appropriate. We therefore conclude that the protective association dominant in a territory as described is a state. However, to remind the listener of our slight weakening of the Weberian condition, we occasionally shall refer to the dominant protective agency as a state-like entity instead of simply as a state. The Invisible Hand Explanation of the State. Have we provided an invisible hand explanation, see Chapter 2, of the states arising within a state of nature? Have we given an invisible hand explanation of the state? The rights possessed by the state are already possessed by each individual in a state of nature. These rights, since they are already contained whole in the explanatory parts, are not provided an invisible hand explanation. Nor have we provided an invisible hand explanation of how the state acquires rights unique to it. This is fortunate, for since the state has no special rights, there is nothing of that sort to be explained. We have explained how, without anyone having this in mind, the self-interested and rational actions of persons in a Lockean state of nature will lead to single protective agencies dominant over geographical territories. Each territory will have either one dominant agency or a number of agencies federally affiliated so as to constitute, in essence, one. And we have explained how, without claiming to possess any rights uniquely, a protective agency dominant in a territory will occupy a unique position. Though each person has a right to act correctly to prohibit others from violating rights, including the right not to be punished unless shown to deserve it, only the dominant protective association will be able, without sanction, to enforce correctness as it sees it. Its power makes it the arbiter of correctness. It determines what, for purposes of punishment, counts as a breach of correctness. Our explanation does not assume or claim that might makes right, but might does make enforced prohibitions, even if no one thinks the mighty have a special entitlement to have realized in the world their own view of which prohibitions are correctly enforced. Our explanation of this de facto monopoly is an invisible hand explanation. If the state is an institution, one that has the right to enforce rights, prohibit dangerous private enforcement of justice, pass upon such private procedures, and so forth, and two, that effectively is the sole wielder within a geographical territory of the right in one, then by offering an invisible hand explanation of two, though not of one, we have partially explained in invisible hand fashion the existence of the state. More precisely, we have partially explained in invisible hand fashion the existence of the ultra-minimal state. What is the explanation of how a minimal state arises? The dominant protective association with the monopoly element is morally required to compensate for the disadvantages it imposes upon those it prohibits from self-help activities against its clients. However, it actually might fail to provide this compensation. Those operating an ultra-minimal state are morally required to transform it into a minimal state, but they might choose not to do so. We have assumed that generally people will do what they are morally required to do. Explaining how a state could arise from a state of nature without violating anyone's rights refutes the principled objections of the anarchist. But one would feel more confidence if an explanation of how a state would arise from a state of nature also specified reasons why an ultra-minimal state would be transformed into a minimal one, in addition to moral reasons, if it specified incentives for providing the compensation or the causes of its being provided, in addition to people's desire to do what they ought. We should note that even in the event that no non-moral incentives or causes are found to be sufficient for the transition from an ultra-minimal to a minimal state, and the explanation continues to lean heavily upon people's moral motivations, it does not specify people's objective as that of establishing a state. Instead, persons view themselves as providing particular other persons with compensation for particular prohibitions they have imposed upon them. The explanation remains an invisible hand one.